Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
Ron, where are you? Because I'm Ken Rudin in San Francisco, courtesy member station KQED.
I envy you. That's a lovely place and a very fine NPR station. I am in Washington.
Haha.
But, you know, some of the nation's political action does take place here in Washington. But right at the moment, I think we should ask you about the nation's political action taking place where you are in California.
Well, there are two very high-profile races here, obviously for governor, where Arnold Schwarzenegger can't run again, and the Senate race, where, unfortunately for many Republicans, Barbara Boxer is running again. And there seems to be this anti-democratic trend around the country, and we've seen it, but that has not translated as much to the West Coast. It seems like Barbara Boxer still has a 4 or 5 point lead over Carly Fiorina.
Now, that's a fairly narrow lead for someone who has won her last term or two pretty easily.
That's true.
In a state that went, what, 62% for Obama just 2 years ago?
That is true. And, you know, there's also a weariness about Barbara Boxer. This week, the Los Angeles Times endorsed her for a fourth term. But at the same time, they talked about her assertiveness borders on arrogance. And I was in KPCC, actually, earlier this week in Pasadena, Los Angeles. And somebody there told me that just listening to Barbara Boxer is like the nails on the chalkboard. And he said that I am definitely going to vote for her because I can't stand Carly Fiorina. This guy was more left of center. But he said that, you know, as a person, they would rather not Barbara Boxer. So perhaps that's what's taking part with a lot of these numbers.
Yeah, I wonder if Barbara Boxer's won any of her current three terms in the Senate or any of her terms in the House on the basis of personality. I think she's always been what they call a spitfire. She's always
in
been
your face,
somebody.
Right.
Yes. And I suppose to some degree the downside of that kind of political character or that kind of political personality is that some people are going to think you come on too strong.
Right. And the matter of fact, this week on Wednesday, the San Francisco Chronicle came out with its endorsement of nobody. They refused to endorse either. They said it was a dismal choice between Boxer and Fiorina. And I suspect that, you know, Fiorina, you know, started off pretty strong. She had, you know, good numbers through most of the summer. But I kind of think that had she been a little different on, say, abortion, to my memory, no very strong pro-life anti-abortion candidate has won in California or can win in California.
No, and that's not since the 80s. Not since the 1980s when they did still win consistently in California. But it turned around in the 90s.
Right, exactly. But the other race we're talking about in California is also a fascinating one because I think the Republicans had more hope in Meg Whitman, the Republican billionaire who's running against Jerry Brown, the state attorney general, former governor, for Schwarzenegger's job. And they thought that Whitman had the numbers. In fact, for the longest time, she did have good numbers. There were some polls that showed her slightly up, slightly behind. Now it says $140 million she spent on her campaign, $119 million out of her own pocket. And, of course, you think after all that money, you know, you'd be ahead of Jerry Brown, who, of course, everybody knows who he is. But she and Fiorina both have problems with Latino voters. They're still wary of them. I think they're more wary of Fiorina than they are of Whitman. And last week, the story about Meg Whitman's former housekeeper, fired by Meg Whitman in 2009 when she found out about her undocumented immigration status and fired her on the spot, that has become the story in California.
The story, of course, is a burden for her, both with Latino voters and with Anglo voters, because Latinos are upset with the way she treated Nikki Diaz, her housekeeper. And the Anglos are, in some cases at least, upset that she, by some reports, had suppressed the information that this person working for her was illegal. That's obviously in dispute. And Meg Whitman says she had no idea. And her husband says he may have seen this letter they got supposedly from the IRS that said that the Social Security numbers didn't match up. There's a factual dispute about this. But some Anglos feel there's some hypocrisy in her making all these ads and talking often on the stump about employers who hire illegal immigrants being part of the problem of illegal immigration.
Right. Her argument from the beginning has been that it's up to the employers. And here we have an employer who is not responsible. And that's what Jerry Brown said in that famous debate on Saturday that has been replayed and replayed on the TV stations here, you know, all the days I've been here. But at the same time, Republicans are also very leery of timing of the whole thing. They say that Glory Allred, the self-promoting activist who brought Nikki Diaz to this press conference last week, Interestingly enough, a day or two before Whitman and Brown debated in a Spanish language debate on Univision, and they say, well, this is not a coincidence because this is the place where Meg Whitman was going to make her serious appeal for Latino votes. But at the same time, look, we learned this with George W. Bush in 2000 when the news about his drunk driving came out right before the election. If you have some secret in your past, you know, you're running for office and you think people won't find out about it, well, think again, because, you know, there's no such thing as secrets when it comes to political campaigns.
That is the lesson of our time. Now, there's also a general characterization of Latino voters that came out this week from the Pew Research Center, which is been measuring Latino sentiment all over the country and finding that Latinos remain about 2-1 Democratic, but they're a lot less enthused about voting this year.
And that's clearly part of the impetus behind what President Obama is doing, going out and trying to reignite, re-excite that core constituency that helped elect him in 2008. At the same time, there's more disillusionment among Hispanic Democrats than Democrats at large, and maybe perhaps only 50% of Hispanic Democrats are talking about coming out to the polls in November. And if that's the case, Democratic hopes on November 2nd will clearly be hurt.
Certainly in the key states where the Hispanic vote is crucial, and that includes California, includes Nevada, includes Arizona, of course. And according to the Pew poll, the thing that makes the Hispanic vote different is that, of course, they attach more importance to the immigration issue, and they've been very disappointed that no real bill was brought in a timely fashion before this last Congress, and that was not one of the top priorities for the Obama administration. But that apart from that, their key concerns, their top concerns, are much like those of other voters.
And one final note about California, though. Again, Meg Whitman, the polls show that she was doing far better than her fellow Republican, Carly Fiorina, among Latino voters. She said during the debate, in fact, that I cannot win this election without Latino voters. And until that flap of last week with Nikki Diaz, the former housekeeper, she was perhaps on her way to getting a larger percentage of Hispanic voters than Republican candidates have been accustomed to getting for years. That we have not seen a poll yet showing what the fallout is from that controversy. But really, the last thing Meg Whitman wanted to spend the last weeks of the campaign talking about was Nikki Diaz rather than the jobs that she says she can bring to California, the haunting $19 billion budget deficit, and what she regards as Jerry Brown's inadequacies in coming to the job.
Absolutely. And let's not count Meg Whitman out with a little less than 4 weeks to go. Yes, she spent $140 million, which is a stunning figure for one state, one race. But she's still got a lot of money left, and I think a lot of people expect her to drop tens of millions of dollars more in the late weeks of this campaign. And she can probably go as far as any candidate could possibly go to erasing a one problematic issue or, for that matter, a 5 or 6 point lead.
As long as we're talking about Meg Whitman and money, there's other money stories out there. There's a group founded by Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie that's raising millions of dollars. Of course, we don't know where the money is actually coming from, but they also have the ability to turn races in the last couple of weeks of the campaign.
That's right. They said they had already given $14 million to key campaigns in the country, the races that might control whether or not the Senate stays Democratic, and that this week they were committing another $4 million for another ad buy. This isn't just general money. This is money that is going specifically to media buys. It's going rubber to the road. It's actually going to affect these races if we know anything about late media spending in close contact. So it's likely to be a big thumb on the scale in the latter days of the campaign. The group you mentioned, American Crossroads, and some other groups as well. And because of that Supreme Court decision last winter called the Citizens United case, in many cases, this is not only okay for corporations to give a lot of money, but in some cases, the FEC is telling us we can't even really find out where the money is coming from.
Right. And of course, the Senate Democrats tried to push measure through Congress to change that. And then Republicans refused to have a vote on that. Mitch McConnell saying they didn't want to change the rules at this late stage of the game. But there is a lot of nervousness among Democrats saying that, well, you know, that a lot of this money can make a big difference in these late changing races. Look what's happening, for example, speaking of races and racy, in West Virginia, which is supposed to be a solidly Democratic seat. There's the Robert Byrd seat. Joe Manchin, the governor, was supposed to win this going away. And yet there's a Rasmussen poll out this week and other polls as well that shows John Racy, the Republican candidate, with a slight lead, let alone, you know, that even a slight lead over Manchin. And again, if that's the case, that could encourage groups like American Crossroads roads to put more money into that race and make that winnable for the Republican Party in a state that has not elected a GOP senator since 1956.
Well, and Racy, of course, has a lot of money of his own. He spent it in the past. It hasn't done him that much good. But this time, he's not only in a huge Republican wave here, but he's in a state that never fell for Barack Obama. And also, he's running against a guy who, while he's real popular as governor, Joe Manchin, Racy can say, you like him as governor? Keep him as governor. Send me to the Senate, and Joe Manchin stays here as your governor. I think that's a pretty effective argument.
There are a lot of cases around the country where, you know, you expect this. We've seen it for both parties doing this, just like the Democrats tried to lump all the Republican candidates with George W. Bush in 2006 and 2008. Republicans are doing it effectively, trying to attach and link Democrats with President Obama or Speaker Nancy Pelosi or Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. And it's working. And we see a lot of Democratic candidates who do not use that word in their ads. They don't use the Democratic label. They just talk about themselves as independent. And obviously, independent is a code word for saying you can't link me to what's going on in Washington, even if they are the incumbents.
The other thing that Democrats are doing in a lot of races is that they're highlighting the flaws, some of the characteristics of their Republican opponents, especially in those instances where Tea Party-backed candidates who were insurgents, who were not the establishment choice of the Republicans in their state, won the nomination nonetheless. We see Lisa Murkowski, of course, still contesting her race in Alaska. But a lot of the attention has gone to a couple of East Coast states. Let's start with your favorite state, Ken, New York.
Why is New York my favorite state? Because the Yankees are in the playoffs for the first time since 2009?
Yes, and the San Francisco Giants are also in the playoffs. And if you want to make friends at KQED, I think you ought to be talking more about the San Francisco Giants.
And the talk, by the way, out here is whether Barry Zito should be part of the rotation. Okay, we'll save that for the baseball podcast. The strange thing about New York is that a lot of people focus on the kind of eccentric, you know, kind of out of the mainstream kind of candidates, like the Carl Paladinos running for governor, the Cristino
Dotti.
Joe DiGuardi. Well, see, but the thing is, Joe DiGuardi is not going to come close to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who was appointed to the Senate. Those numbers are not even comparable.
Hold on now. You cited Rasmussen poll in West Virginia, and we've been paying a lot of attention to a couple of these races and a couple of these tight polls. There is a poll in New York that shows Kirsten Gillibrand has not put away Joe DiGuardi, and there are polls of this kind in state after state.
Well, the fascinating thing about polls is in the New York gubernatorial race with Carl Paladino, he is trailing Andrew Cuomo by as much as 20 to 25 points. And yet the poll that just came out that said that 59% of the people can't stand. Well, I don't know if they said they can't stand, but they have an unfavorable view of Andrew Cuomo. Here's a guy who's going to most likely become the next governor of New York. And yet they don't even like the guy they're going to vote for.
Well, they're voting for the guy because basically they don't really have what you would call a rational choice. Carl Paladino, I don't know if you heard his interview with Robert Siegel on NPR the other day or heard him telling a reporter for the New York Post that he was going to take him out.
Sure. You send another goon to my daughter's house and I'll take you out, buddy.
You're going to take me out?
Yeah.
How are you going to do that?
Watch.
Of course, he later said that he was offering to take him on some sort of a date. But at any rate, this is not a mainstream candidate. This is not somebody with much of a chance of winning statewide, and yet people are going to vote for Andrew Cuomo because that's their choice.
And a similar thing going on in Delaware. We've said from the beginning that it had Mike Castle been the Republican nominee, yes, he's a liberal Republican, but if you're a Republican strategist and you want to pick up more seats in the Senate, you want Mike Castle as your nominee. Now you have Christine O'Donnell, who beat him in the primary, and now she's running an ad explaining the fact that she's not a witch. I'm one of you.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you.
Well, she may not be a witch, but I'm not sure if she's one of us, at least in Delaware, where she seems to be trailing Democrat Chris Coons by like anywhere between 15 and 19 points.
So in these races, and let's throw into this mix the Connecticut Senate race, where Chris Dodd retired, Richard Blumenthal stepped in as the Democratic nominee. He was thought to be the ideal Democratic candidate, and maybe he was. He had the problem with misstating his Vietnam record in a way that has been a serious blow to a lot of other candidates in the post-Vietnam era. And He seemed to survive it in the polls, but now, here again, the Quinnipiac poll, as in New York and some other places, shows this race a lot closer than anyone thought it was going to be. And the other night, in the debate with Linda McMahon, she took him to task for that Vietnam misrepresentation, and he looked more than a little bit on the defensive.
Apparently so, and I think the Democratic Senatorial Committee must feel the same way, because they're now starting to pump in a lot of money in that race, and that's not a race where you expected them to spend money at all. But, you know, we seem to be kind of thrown aback by all these polls. There was a Newsweek poll out the other day that even showed the Democrats with a net positive in generic numbers. And then there's a Rasmussen poll that had generic Republicans up by 3 points, which is the closest it's been in a long time. And so Democrats said, wow, maybe the things are turning our way. Maybe the Democrats are coming out of their funk and they will show up at the polls on November 2nd. And you have a Gallup poll which shows anywhere between a 13 and an 18 point generic swing for the Republican Party. And then it says, well, maybe this will be a Republican blowout after all. So the polls are
are all polls that have their believers. The Gallup poll has been the gold standard for decades. Some of these other polls, the Newsweek poll, I think, might have a provocative factor. I think some of these other polls may be looking for a headline. The Rasmussen methodology has been somewhat controversial, and many people feel that their definition of a likely voter leans Republican.
And yet the Rasmussen showed it better for the Democrats than it has in months.
That's right. And the Gallup poll, which has been the best measure from a Democratic standpoint for months, showing them even in the generic vote, at least among registered voters, has suddenly turned against them. So it's a maddening melange of contradictory information in a specific kind of information that is supposed to be precise and objective and mathematical.
Well, that's the problem with relying on polls. I mean, these polls become the story. If I see one poll that has the Republicans up big, the headlines say Republicans are going to win big. If there's a poll that has the Democrats doing better than expected, Obama and the Democrats are coming back. What you really got to do with less than a month to go is not look at generic numbers. It is race by race by race. And in that sense, it's a pretty tough to imagine Republicans winning the 10 seats they need to take control of the Senate, but not as tough, not as difficult as it is for them to win the 39 seats in the House they need to take control.
In fact, I would say it's tough to believe the Democrats can hold them off in the House. I would say that the probability factor is the reverse for the two chambers, that in the House, the Republicans look like they've really got the wind at their back. They're going to be mighty hard to keep out, whereas on the Senate side, the presumption is that the Democrats barely hang on.
One race that a lot of people are talking about is not going to even happen on November 2nd. It's going to happen on February 22nd. That's the race for mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, the former White House chief of staff, who left Washington this week, announced that he's likely going to run for mayor of Chicago. And what Democrats are nervous about with all this attention on Rahm Emanuel, they also have a very tough governorship and a Senate seat to defend. The last thing they want is all the focus to be on Rahm Emanuel and next year's mayoral election, which, of course, won't matter to anybody outside of the city of Chicago. And yet Democrats are nervous that that is sucking up all the oxygen in the room.
One more instance of the national media perhaps focusing on the last thing or the next thing, but never the right thing from the standpoint of the people who are trying to win these other races. How do you feel about Rahm's chances? I mean, there are a lot of candidates. He is by no means a sure thing to be the favorite among the Democrats. I wonder, though, if to some degree that doesn't work in his favor, just because there are so many other people running.
Well, there seems to be one guy, the Cook County Sheriff, who is a big favorite of progressives. He is a big favorite of Latinos and African Americans. If there's not another black candidate who gets in the race, perhaps the sheriff has a shot at beating Emanuel. He has a strong record. Whereas Rahm Emanuel, I mean, you want to talk to Jewish voters about Rahm Emanuel and President Obama's views on the Mideast. They're not going to be so happy. There are a lot of progressives who are not happy with Rahm Emanuel's constant seeming to want to move President Obama in a centrist direction. Rahm Emanuel's feeling was results matter more than ideology. Look, they always say there's no liberal or conservative way of picking up the garbage, especially in some place like Chicago, but there might be a lot of bruised feelings out there about what Rahm Emanuel's been doing for the last 19 months in Washington.
So it becomes one more chance for people to express their disappointment with their own city resident, Barack Obama. One thing I do want to get you to comment on, Ken, we have a historically unprecedented situation this fall because the World Series is starting so late, October 27th. That's one day off of a record late start for the World Series. Three games have been scheduled in November this year, and two of them after the election. How long have you heard people saying Americans don't really focus on the election until after the World Series? What are we going to do if the World Series isn't over on Election Day?
Well, it doesn't look like it will, and that's what's so remarkable. First of all, not only is the baseball season starting later than ever in history, but of course, November 2nd is on the calendar the earliest an election could be held. It has to be the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, and November 2nd is the earliest it could be. So, look, I think there are people who will focus on baseball and ignore the election. There are people who will focus on the election and ignore baseball. But the fact that they're competing at the same time is something that we've never seen, and I just wonder. We're talking about turnout and one side being enthused and the other side not being enthused. I wonder if whatever focus there is on baseball in the World Series will even detract from November 2nd on the elections more than we ever expected.
I would expect there to be some cerebral overload for Ken Rudin, for certain. And that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Baseball, It's All Politics from NPR.
If I pitch, can you catch? Will you hold the ball? When you step to the plate, will you swing and fall? If you play, you gotta know how it's done. Can you catch? Can you hold a high?